Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club.
Welcome to the Commonwealth Club. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. We're going to have Stephen Talbot's film, Movement and the Madman, about President Nixon and one of his decisions and how it was influenced by us. Half the people here. How many tried to influence President Nixon's decision back in 1968? All right, one, two, three, a few others. Okay, great. All right, perfect. So you can see what side I am by my tie. So we're going to show the film, and then I'll ask a few questions of Stephen to get it warmed up for the Q&A, and then everybody can ask Stephen questions about it. The film. You can ask about the artistic part of it or the factual part of it, whichever you'd like to talk about. Roll them.
Massive anti-war march with a quarter to a half million people is supposed to come down Pennsylvania Avenue and pass the White House November 15th.
Nixon is going into an offensive mode against the demonstrators, and he knows that on November 15th, there's going to be a mass demonstration led by the new mob.
The positive coverage that had been the case with the moratorium, Nixon doesn't want that to happen again.
So I wrote Nixon a memo and said it's time to attack the media. And I said the Vice President of the United States ought to deliver this speech. And so I wrote that Agnew speech. And there was one editor for that Agnew speech, Richard Milhouse Nixon. And he said, this will tear the scab off those bastards. And we broke out laughing. And it did.
How many marches and demonstrations would we have if the marchers did not know that the ever-faithful TV cameras would be there to record their antics for the next movie?
They get Agnew to give a major speech attacking the media, and they put pressure on the media to run Agnew's speech in its entirety, which they do.
Nixon has his vice president, Spiro Agnew, go on the attack directly against the media. He attacked the elitism of the Eastern elites, the people in Washington and New York. He earlier had called them the nattering nabobs of negativism. Who elected these people to tell you what to think?
The views of a majority of this fraternity do not, and I repeat, not represent the views of America.
It is interesting to note that journalism scholars think this is the beginning of the American people beginning to lose faith in their media.
Stephen, you want to come up? So here's the man behind that movie, Stephen Talbot.
Thank you.
That must have been actually hard to make.
Yes, it was.
I mean, emotionally hard to make in addition to physically.
Yes, actually it was. So there are blinding lights here. If I might, I'm just going to introduce a couple of people.
Sure, absolutely.
Quickly, first of all, the man who really initiated this whole project, it was his idea. He got us over the finish line with funding and editorial judgment. Robert Levering is here with us. Robert, thank you again. Also, Blanche Chase, who did all the archival work in the film, archival research. Blanche Chase, who works here, San Francisco. And one of the people in the film, David Hartso, the Quaker lobbyist and activist who wrote a great book about his own life, Waging Peace. David Hartso is here. Thank you. And I'm not sure, is John Gage here? Okay, he was going to make it, but couldn't. He was the guy who put together the sound stage at Woodstock with a group of people and then took that same stage to the Boston Common for the moratorium and then built the stage in Washington for the November 15th demonstration. So if those of you who remember Woodstock or have read about it or seen it, Wavy Gravy and the bus brought his whole gang down to Washington and set up the soundstage for the November 15th march.
That was such a visual trip back to So how terrible that time was. And it's also, among all the other elements of it that were all so familiar, the thing that seemed so dissonant was that all the politicians and all the speakers seemed to make sense when they talked. You know, that everybody had a certain way of discoursing to the public and talking about it and saying their side or saying, I'm not going to listen, or you know, whatever they said, it doesn't seem recognizable to what we have now.
Well, you know,
and I find that very weird.
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, when we came up with the title for this film, The Movement and the Madman, and knowing that Madman is a strategy, although as Daniel Ellsberg said, some people thought Nixon was mad. He was certainly paranoid. When we announced that title, some people thought it was going to be about QAnon and Trump. But it was a different movement, a different madman. What I will say is the person who kind of broke the mold of that discourse was Agnew.
Right.
And, you know, those speeches were written for him by Sapphire and Pat Buchanan, William Sapphire and Pat Buchanan. And Agnew, though, was the attack dog. And it doesn't really come through in the film as much as I wanted it to, but Agnew was really, he was pretty vicious, and he worked up crowds. So I think he was an early purveyor of the kind of rhetoric we have today in politics.
Well, I thought it was interesting how Pat Buchanan was laughing about what he had done. I thought that was great that you captured that in the film. It kind of showed how they thought about the situation, about such a serious situation. And we have all these big issues today, and obviously many, many people are dying in Israel right now. But I think the large number of people that were dying all the time during the Vietnam War is something we haven't had since the Vietnam War.
That's right. If you look back, I mean, the number of people killed, wounded, and forced to leave their homes in the Vietnam War, and that war, of course, extended to Laos and to Cambodia, horribly, was phenomenal. I mean, it was not World War II. It was not World War II, but it was millions of people.
Yeah.
We have not had a war like that since.
Even you know, what's going on in Ukraine and everything, there's still the deaths are maybe under 100,000 or something like that. That's still terrible, but I think, and unfortunately, the media, as everybody remembers, did not at the beginning cover how many people were dying there. They covered the Americans dying, but they, you know, and we've done that quite often in the Iraq War, the first Iraq War, too. Mm-hmm. Oh, so many Americans died, and don't mention the 200,000 Iraqis that died, that kind of thing.
Right.
But one fact, I mean, it's interesting that it perhaps prevented a nuclear use, but if I have my dates right, at the end of 69, didn't the bombing of Laos and Cambodia come after this?
Yes.
Yeah.
So what happened here, let me say, the anti-war movement, and we thought this was very important to show, has often been stereotyped, dismissed in official histories of this and other films. And we wanted to show that actually the anti-war movement was much broader than people remember, that it was the largest movement in the history of the United States, any kind of protest movement, certainly in the middle of a war, that people, millions of people would be mobilized across a broad spectrum of humanity, including bipartisan political opposition. So we wanted to show that was very, very important, and sort of, you know, something that has been left out of the history books.
Yeah.
Remind me of where we're going here.
Well, we're going to, it did end up in not exactly the plan that Nixon had.
That's right.
But he got an alternative from
that. That's right. Yeah. So the anti-war movement did have an impact, as we show in this film. But Nixon, when he persisted, he went on to invade Cambodia the following spring, to invade Laos. Laos, poor, you know, country of 3 million people or so, had the heaviest bombing per capita of any place in the entire world. The Plain of Jars, I mean, it was just horrendous what happened in Laos. And in Cambodia, we all know that bombing helped drive that country crazy, which led to the genocide there. Yeah. So various things that he outlined in Duck Hook, mm-hmm. Laos and Cambodia were on that
right,
list, so
that,
he did it. And eventually, in December 72, right before the peace agreement is signed, mm-hmm. He bombs Hanoi. I went and visited Bach Mai Hospital in the following year in downtown Hanoi mm-hmm. and saw that our B-52s bombed the largest hospital in mm-hmm. Hanoi. Mm-hmm. So he did many of the things that he was planning to do, which were terrible and also absolutely unnecessary mm-hmm. because the peace agreement that's finally signed in January 73 is something that most historians would now say Nixon and Kissinger could have gotten immediately mm-hmm. in 1969 when they first took office, mm-hmm. but they chose not to.
Yeah.
The other thing the anti-war movement did, two things. One is it forced an end to the draft, mm-hmm. and it forced Nixon to withdraw U.S. ground troops, mm-hmm. which Nixon did do. Nixon did not want to, and Kissinger definitely did not want to. Mm-hmm. They wanted to maintain the army there as much as long as possible to prop up a regime in Saigon. Mm-hmm. That's what they wanted to do, and they did that for as long as possible. But interestingly enough, Melvin Laird, who was the Secretary of Defense, and if you remember him, he was bald and looked like a bulldog mm-hmm. and could easily be caricatured as a pro-war guy. And he was a very conservative person. Mm-hmm. But he had been in Congress and he had his hand on the pulse of the American mm-hmm. Electorate. And he knew that the game was over, that you had to pull out U.S. troops. Mm-hmm. The anti-war movement was too powerful and public opinion had changed. So Nixon did, as slowly as he could, mm-hmm. but he did withdraw U.S. forces from Vietnam, kept up the bombing.
Yeah. The timeline of the Paris peace talks, I found one of those most interesting things in the movie was this fact that the Paris peace talks were an opportunity for blackmail mm-hmm. or nuclear blackmail.
Right.
Not surprising, but I had not heard that before. And
yes.
But that was in 1969 that we're talking about. Then what were the secret talks that later on in Paris that everyone talked about? Wasn't it right before the 72 election, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, so there are secret talks that are occurring throughout the Nixon administration. I mean, Kissinger and Nixon, as Roger Morris says, in the end, foreign policy would be the two of them.
Right.
They really ran, a tight ship. It was filled with leaks, and filled with paranoia, and Nixon was anti-Semitic towards Kissinger, and there was a lot of chaos and paranoia in that White House, which ultimately leads, of course, to Watergate and Nixon's resignation, But they're at this for a long time, these two.
Yeah, some of the...
And the Paris peace, so they're constantly doing things in secret. Constantly doing things in secret. Yeah. So they're the public Paris peace talks with Lei Duc Tho and Henry Kissinger going to these public meetings. But behind the scenes, they're doing these secret meetings in which they're making these constant threats, including... threats of using nuclear weapons. Mm-hmm. And the thing about nuclear weapons, which seems so extreme, like, oh my God, would they really have done this? There's a history to this. Mm-hmm. When the French colonialists were still battling to control Vietnam, at the Battle of Dien Bien Phu, they were surrounded by North Vietnamese forces, Ho Chi Minh's forces, General Giap, and Eisenhower offered them nuclear weapons, the French. Mm-hmm. And the French said, nuclear weapons? What are you, crazy? Mm-hmm. I mean, our troops are surrounded. If we drop nuclear weapons, they're going to affect our troops. And, God knows what it's going to do to the world. It's too dangerous. And said no. Mm-hmm. General Westmoreland, at the Battle of Khe Sanh, wanted to bring in tactical nuclear weapons too. And Lyndon Johnson, to his credit, and the plan was pretty far along, Lyndon Johnson, when he found out about it, said, to his credit, that's madness. Mm-hmm. You're not going to drop a tactical nuke. So Johnson stopped that one. Mm-hmm. So there were constant threats. I mean, the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese at the Paris peace talks were asked at one point, how many times were you seriously threatened with nuclear weapons, use of nuclear weapons by the United States? And they said 13 times.
Well, I'd like to keep asking a lot of questions, but I'm sure everybody else does too. So let's take questions from the audience. And as I said, you can talk about the facts or you can talk about the art.
Thank you so much for making this movie. I was looking for myself in the protest in November in San Francisco.
Good.
But I was curious as when Nixon threatened Russia, you know, with all that posturing. Mm-hmm. And you said that Russia had not responded. What did they actually do? I'm sure it wasn't just silence.
Well, that's a really important question. And if you ask the experts about this who have done the research, including William Burr, who's the man who spoke in the film, who's in the at the National Security Archive at George Washington University, what they'll tell you is that the Russians have never opened up their archives. Mm-hmm. So no one outside of Russia knows actually what the Russian response was to that threat. I'll tell you one thing about that threat. You know, if, for those of you who know about nuclear weapons strategy or have seen the film Dr. Strangelove, which was shockingly accurate, you know, in terms of its description of how the B-52s were in the air all the time. Mm. There was a policy of having B-52s with nuclear weapons on them constantly in the air back in the Cold War. And the problem was that sometimes those planes had accidents. Mm. And there was a big crash of a B-52 in Palomares, Spain, that scattered plutonium over an agricultural area that no nuclear bomb went off. It's hard to make one go off, actually. Mm. But the high explosive in a bomb can go off, and it scattered this plutonium. And it happened again in 1968 in Greenland. There was a B-52, an American B-52, that crashed with nuclear weapons and also scattered plutonium. And as a result of those two serious accidents, which are known in Pentagon parlance as broken arrows, when those happened, they grounded all the B-52s. They said it's too dangerous to have that policy. So the B-52s could be put on alert, but they were not flying around all the time with nuclear weapons. The first time that that happened after that accident was when Nixon ordered this in October 1969. So those planes that were those B-52s that took off from California and other bases in the States flew up over northern Alaska and went right up to the border of the Soviet Union, the Arctic border. So, you know, it's the kind of thing that China does in Taiwan now or, you know, that other people do to terrify opponents where this is playing with nuclear weapons, though. And so if you're Russia sitting there with radar and all your, you know, intelligence gear, and you suddenly see B-52s that you know are armed with nuclear weapons headed for your, you know, border, and they would go up, this went on for something like 2 weeks, they would go up and then turn around right at the last minute and come back. Well, you know, thank God the Russians didn't respond to it.
Were they silent to the Americans?
There's no diplomatic records of back and forth of this. It was like they pretended it didn't happen.
God, that's amazing.
Other questions? Yeah.
I normally don't like hypothetical questions, but as you know, in 1968, the presidential elections are very close. Let's say, hypothetically, Richard Nixon lost and Humphrey won. We just saw and know the history of Nixon and the Vietnam War. What do you think the history would have been with Humphrey if he had been elected? What would he have done differently? And do you think it would have ended sooner?
Well, that's a question that none of us will ever know, for sure. I will say this. I was a student demonstrating, college student demonstrating against the war, and I was too young to vote in 68 still. But I was leading demonstrations against, you know, local demonstrations in New England against Humphrey as well as Nixon. Mm-hmm. And I, at the time, told people to boycott the election. You know, in retrospect, many years later, I did a film about the year 1968, and I interviewed a lot of people, including Barbara Ehrenreich and Todd Gitlin and Tom Hayden and others who were very involved in the demonstrations. And raising just that point, was the anti-war movement wrong in boycotting the election, voting for a third party, not supporting Humphrey? Many of you will know that Humphrey, of course, was deeply involved in the Vietnam War and supporting Johnson's war policy. When Johnson dropped out because of, almost losing in New Hampshire, not really. And Sam Brown, Robert and I once had with a three-hour version of this film. And so there was a lot more. But some of you may know Sam Brown, who is one of the four main leaders of the moratorium. He was the main leader of the students who came to New Hampshire to support Eugene McCarthy, Clean for Gene. I was one of those people who cut my hair and supported McCarthy. At the very end of the 68 campaign, Nixon was ahead in the polls, but Humphrey finally came out and called for a bombing halt. And when Humphrey said that, it was a big speech, I believe it was in Salt Lake City, but it was a big speech, it was like a week or two before the election, suddenly Humphrey's poll numbers went up. And in the end, that was one of the closest elections in the history of the United States. So who knows? Humphrey was a liberal, but he was a cold warrior. Would he have ended the war sooner than Nixon? I'd like to think so, but I don't know.
I'm 80 years old. This was right in the middle of my vulnerable years, I'll put it. And I'm still unsure of myself what exactly we accomplished, especially when I look at U.S. foreign policy, even for the last 20 years. But I had forgotten until it said in here, we ended the draft. Mm-hmm. And for those of us who lived through that, that is almost as important as stopping any bombing. Mm-hmm. The effect of the draft on your lives as an 18 to 25-year-old is incomprehensible to people who did not live through it. And I remembered when I was fighting it with everything I could, my personal draft. Mm-hmm. I discovered that the first, I forgot, in General Hershey, I think it was.
Yes, it was.
The first head of the draft. And he came out and said, the purpose of the draft is not to get people to become soldiers. It's to get people to become doctors and teachers and keep them in college. Mm-hmm. And I thought, this is such bullshit. And really, ending the draft, to me, was as important as anything else that was done.
Well, and of course, Robert worked on a film earlier about draft resistors who played a key role. People, again, forget how many people actually resisted the draft and went to jail, went to prison in many cases. And then there were people who left the country, who went to Canada, Sweden, other places. No, it was a huge burden. It was the Damocles sword over every male of a certain age in that era.
The boys that said no.
Absolutely. That's the film.
Thank you for your presentation. And I did have one question. There's a name that hasn't come up tonight, and I wondered maybe if you have any comments. His name's Robert McNamara. Mm-hmm. And how he fit in with Kissinger and Nixon here in this this plan. Yeah.
Yes. Well, of course, the war had been going on for at least 4 or 5 years before Nixon was elected. You'll remember, many of you, the Gulf of Tonkin, which turns out to have been, a phony incident. But that's what precipitated major U.S. involvement in the war. It had started earlier. And McNamara was the architect of that war, along with, of course, Lyndon Johnson and his National Security Council and others. Again, for a film I made years ago in the 60s, I actually interviewed McNamara, and I interviewed Kissinger, too. And the difference between them is that McNamara, one difference between them, is that McNamara finally came in a quite anguished way to say he realized it was a mistake, the war. And he wrote a book in retrospect, and he went to North Vietnam and met with the Vietnamese to discuss the war and so forth. So I wish he had spoken out a hell of a lot earlier. He kept silent about that for so long. He, I think, has a lot of blood on his hands. I know his son, who's written about his relationship with him, you know, had a very, very difficult time with his father. But Kissinger never expressed one word of regret ever. And I'll tell you a story that I've written about, which was that when I went to interview Kissinger, this was 25 years ago, it was right after I'd interviewed McNamara, and McNamara was filled with anguish and, you know, what have I done kind of interview. And I went to Kissinger, and I interviewed him at Kissinger and Associates in New York, and a very heavy security, all decorated with things he had brought back from China, from his various trips. He was doing mainly business deals at this stage, with arranging business deals in China and getting very well paid for it. I walked in, and he was in a foul mood and saw me, and I was there with my crew. This had all been arranged that we would have this interview. It took a long time to arrange. And he said, you know, who the hell are you? And I said, well, we're public TV. We're here for this interview. And he sort of stormed off to this office like, I don't really want to do this. And I thought, oh, my God, you know, this whole thing. So then he called me in to his office, closed the door, and said, if you call me a war criminal, you know, this interview is off. You know, it's not even going to start. I said, okay, well, there goes half my questions. But I thought he really was not going to do the interview. So my ace in the hole was to say, I've just come from Washington, and I interviewed Robert McNamara. And honestly, Kissinger did this. He turned to me and he went, boo-hoo, boo-hoo, what did he do? Crocodile tears, I'm so sorry, boo-hoo. And I thought, oh my God, you know, this is Henry Kissinger. So he was not a man who had great compassion.
You're trying for the understatement of the century or something here. I interviewed Craig McNamara when his book Because Our Fathers Lied came out, and he was in the anti-war movement at Stanford while his father was in the middle of the war. And then he went to South America. A very interesting story. It's about an hour interview, so if you want to see that, it's on YouTube. Because Our Fathers Lied. Very interesting.
I will say, now that you mentioned that, you know, there were quite a few sons and daughters of people in Johnson's administration and Nixon's who opposed the war. Mm-hmm. Kim Agnew, who was the young teenage daughter of Spiro Agnew, tried to get to the moratorium, mm-hmm. and she was grounded by the family. And so a few of us remember buttons at the time that said, free Kim Agnew. But Melvin Laird, who, as I say, was for withdrawing the troops, mm-hmm. ground troops, his son, John Laird, was a college student in Wisconsin. He took part in the moratorium.
Yeah. Three-hour version.
Yes, he was in our three-hour version.
I think you've probably partially already answered this question. But I was interested in what might be termed the opposition voices in the movie, so Stephen Bull and mm-hmm. Buchanan. Mm-hmm. Was that based on interviews with them? Did they speak with you directly, or was that footage you pulled from somewhere else?
No, all these interviews are original. They're all original interviews. Now, the Buchanan interview and the Kissinger interview were from previous documentaries that I'd made. So I interviewed them before I started on this documentary, and I had that material. But all the other interviews in the film, including Stephen Bull, who was Nixon's personal aide and a total loyalist right down to the very end.
To this day.
In fact, when I interviewed him, he toyed with me in saying, I wonder if I was the guy who erased the 16 minutes on the tape. Because I was really in a much better position to do it than Rosemary Woods, the secretary. anyway, he was a hardcore Nixon loyalist and now a Trump guy.
Sure.
Why did he want to speak with you for this film? Was it, did in his mind, was he committed, I'm going to set the record straight? I'm going to change people's minds about Nixon?
Good question. Ultimately, I don't know the absolute answer of why he decided. I've been doing interviews for documentaries for 40 years, and I'm always amazed at the number of people who will talk. Of course, there are people who refuse and run away. But in general, people like to talk. And if you are fair in the sense you're going to let people have their say and have that be in the film, then they tend to respect that and go for that, even if they don't like your overall editorial position. So he was happy to talk. He was quite full of himself.
One last question.
So thank you so much for the film. Actually, I grew up in China, and I went to Stanford for graduate school. That's how I came here. And very interesting because, you know, like President Nixon actually was one of the most beloved president of the United States in China. And when you talk about Dr. Kissinger, it's very interesting because I grew up in Dalian, and every year we invited him for a closing festival. And I don't know how much we paid him, but we always call him our old friend from America. So, you know, like Chinese people really love those two people. But now I know they are like quite stupid and evil.
Well, yeah, people are complicated. And foreign policy is complicated.
Yeah.
And I still think it was a very good thing that Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger did the opening
broke
to China.
Ice.
That was very, very important.
Yeah.
They did it hardly for entirely altruistic reasons. One of the main reasons was to try to get China to stop supporting the North Vietnamese.
Yeah, and also
to try to get the Russians to
for China
it.
To get rid of Russia too. So it's
precisely
not just
and to split Russia and China.
Exactly. So. Yeah. So I have a question. I'm very interested in were there any Asian leaders in the the anti-Vietnam War? Like the whole, because from the movie, we only saw, black or white leaders. I didn't see any Asian faces. I know there were a lot of going on actually in Asian communities around that time because, Asians were the ones being called gooks.
Sure.
I think that's a word. Mm-hmm. And I'm very curious about the history there because I didn't see any, footage on that.
Yes. Well, there were, especially here in San Francisco because there was a sizable Asian American population. And so toward the late 60s and definitely into the 70s, there was a real resurgence of political activity of Asian Americans here, starting in opposition to the Vietnam War. Then there, of course, were big, this is another issue, but there were big battles in Chinatown here between nationalist Chinese and people who were supporting mainland China and Mao. The 70s were kind of wild in San Francisco in that regard.
And many other regards as well.
That's right. That's true.
At that time, I was outside looking in.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Stephen, first of all, for making the film and for the people who supported making the film. Okay. That's really great.
Thank you. I'll say, people often ask what they could do. The film was broadcast originally on the PBS series American Experience last year. It's now available on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's available on Canopy, the library service. This is streaming. And PBS, Passport.
Mm-hmm.
So those are three places you can tell friends to go see the film. And they can rate the film and leave comments and all that sort of thing. And that's very helpful because the film is being distributed by PBS internationally. It was just shown in Australia on a major national network. It's been shown by PBS America in England. The French have bought it, and the Vietnamese have bought it.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking forward to when this is going to be broadcast nationally in Vietnam. They might be waiting till next year.
Mm-hmm.
Because of the anniversary of the final end of the war. But that will be very interesting to go to Vietnam talk to it, to people there about the film. So please spread the word, and schools. We want to get this in as many. We've been showing it in quite a few universities. So those of you who know teachers, and tell them about the film.
I think one of the great outcomes of the whole film and the history of this is these two guys thought they had this strategy that would create a certain outcome. You know, you can't create any outcomes in this world that, you know, that you can predict on that kind of scale. And yes, the communists took over Vietnam, but then it went in this direction, then it went in this direction, and then we started working together. And the same thing is going to be true about Taiwan and China, and nobody can know. I lived in Hong Kong for a while back in the 70s, and everybody was afraid of that coming in. So then it came in, and everything was fine for a while, and now it's bad again. You know, who can make these predictions about what those leaders are going to be? And I think if people realize that the ideology of the leaders is almost irrelevant to the outcomes and how they behave and how they make their decisions. Because
Well, and it's amazing. I'll leave you with this. You know, Anthony Lake, Tony Lake, who was the aide to Henry Kissinger and who resigned over the invasion of Cambodia. So did Roger Morris. Morton Halperin had left earlier. Tony Lake, you know, became Bill Clinton's national security advisor. And he's, you know, still very active. Tony Lake, again, he says it in the film, but we had more in the longer version. What Tony Lake said is, you know, the fundamental mistake, and he had been, as a very young man, in the embassy, as you see him, you know, in Vietnam, reporting back, you know, in the early 60s, saying this war is not going well, and this is a mistake. Why was it a mistake? Because the United States always saw it in global big power terms, especially Kissinger and Nixon. When in fact, you know, the Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, there was a Communist Party leading it and so forth, but they were nationalists. And the United States, completely U.S. foreign policy establishment, missed the fact that this was a nationalist struggle, that it was an anti-colonial struggle, it was an anti-imperial struggle, and, you know, Ho Chi Minh said nothing is more precious than independence and freedom, and that's what they were going to die for. And they were going to do that, they were going to fight to the bitter end for that, because it was about nationalism. It was their country and wanting their independence. And the United States never got that at the foreign policy level until it was way too late.
Yeah, just as an advance, April 30th of 2025 and May 2nd, Humanities West is putting on a program here at the Commonwealth Club, Lessons Unlearned, the 50th anniversary of the end of Vietnam War. And we have historians coming in and many other people to talk about it, including a Vietnamese woman who runs programs between Vietnam and everything and the United States. And, you know, trying to give a different perspective on why do we keep doing this? And you look at it and you say, what did we learn? You know, you talk about the communism and versus nationalism, like a really big point to miss. I mean, but how many points? I mean, we seem in Iraq, we didn't seem to notice, for example, that there were Sunnis and Shias.
That's right.
You know, and that this is going to have an influence on what's going the outcome is going to be. And they had just finished in Yugoslavia, where they had a very similar problem, and they still didn't notice. I just, yeah. Anyway. It's good to have some history written down, explained accurately, so somebody in the future reads it.
We hope so.
And somebody learns something.
We hope so.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you.
My pleasure. Okay. It was great, Stephen. Okay. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you for coming.
In its 121st year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.
You've been listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Hear thousands of our podcasts on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher. If you like what you've heard, please consider supporting our work and help us bring 500 programs a year to listeners like you. Go to commonwealthclub.org/donate. Think your way around the world with our travel programs to exciting domestic and international destinations. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live at our events. Thank you for listening and for your support.